The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. There's no need to ask what's the catch with their $15 a month for 3 months wireless plan, because there is no catch. That's right, no catch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/dark. That's mintmobile.com/dark. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/dark. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speeds slower than 40 gigabyte on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15, Episode 3. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing two tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Kyle Harrison and Seth Paul. Tonight, we'll hear stories of mutant malfeasance and senseless storage. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first spine-tingling story. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. There was once a time, not long ago, when it was thought radiation was not going to bring about the end of the world, but instead a completely different one. A wasteland filled with horrific beings with far too many parts and not enough brains to reason with. Of course, there were also visions of dune buggies and mohawks aplenty, so not everything was hunky-dory. But that doesn't mean we still don't have our worries about the bombs dropping. Tonight, we dig into the weird and wacky world of atoms and their consequences. Kyle Harrison starts things off with a tale sure to make you very much concerned about where you go to sleep at night, because you just might wake up in an unfamiliar place, a place that has a vested interest in teaching a lesson, whether you survive or not. Without further ado, I present to you Armageddon Drill. I woke up with a pulsing headache, a throbbing pain at the back of my head. The world was dizzying for a moment, and I couldn't even properly make out any shapes or colors. As I came to, I soon realized that I was handcuffed to what looked like a school desk. A quick study of my surroundings told me this was accurate. There was a man right alongside me, also on the floor, cuffed to a desk, and behind him, another, and behind him, another. I was in some kind of classroom with at least a dozen or so people, all of whom seemed to be chained up. My eyes took in the surrounding posters and artwork. There were children's drawings and safety reminders, all scattered across the wall, most of them older than I was. A lot of them were connected to nuclear fallout and taking shelter. Then my attention went to the front of the class, the blackboard, where a teacher should have been to instruct. In its place was a simple, concise message written in chalk and large enough for all of us to read. Armageddon drill begins, 8:05 a.m. I checked the wall for the clock. According to it, we only had a few minutes before the event was supposed to happen, so I talked fast. Hey, you, where are we? I asked, kicking the man's foot next to me. His eyes flared at me suspiciously. Like I would know? How should I know? We could be in hell for all I know. I decided not to bother talking to him anymore and turned to my left. A petite young woman was there. What about you? Do you remember how we got here? I asked, yanking on the handcuffs. The sound they made as they rattled against the desk was echoing everywhere. I was in the mall with my boyfriend, and we were headed toward the food court when... I don't remember anything after that, she admitted timidly. I could tell by the look on her face as she was more worried about her boyfriend than her own safety. But something told me that pretty soon that would change. The clock struck 8:05 a moment later, and suddenly this shrill, scratchy noise came over the PA intercom. The system had a date back to prior than the 1980s. I thought to myself as I tried to cup my free hand over my ear and hold my head against the desk. It reminded me of what would play when an atom bomb dropped. Attention, class, we're now under attack. Prepare yourselves for the worst, a very strange voice announced. It was difficult to say for sure what gender it was, even. It didn't sound quite human. Then there was a sharp click, and a grainy old recording of protection against radiation came over on the speakers. As it finished, all of us looked at one another in confusion and fear. What the hell was going on? Attention, room 3, your bomb drill will begin now. Move to the hallway. How in the hell are we supposed to do that? I said out loud. Not that I expected the strange machine to respond. Instead, there was a loud rattling from above, and it made me look at the ceiling of the room for the first time. Above every desk, there was an air vent, and on cue, those vents opened. Then, abruptly, loud noises and shards of glass spit out from the vents and straight toward us. I reacted in a moment, yanking my body toward the floor as the broken glass sliced across the back of my neck. Using the top of the desk as cover, I did my best to huddle there, a portion of my thigh and right foot damaged from the sudden, unexpected rush of projectiles. Others in the class weren't so lucky. A man sitting two desks in front of me had a shard of glass impaled straight in the neck. A woman had several hit her across her cheek, and a rain of sharp blades continued to come. "The hallway!" the woman beside me shouted. "We can scoot the desks and use them for cover." I nodded and slowly pushed my desk that was acting as a shield as the rest of the ceiling seemed to rumble and shake, and the broken glass was now being replaced by more dangerous burning chemicals. Those that weren't under their desks were given second-degree burns as we all shouted for them to take cover and then move. The hallway felt like it was a lifetime away. I pushed the desk slowly, doing my best to try and time the pattern of the falling chemicals and glass. My hands were already burnt from them and my shins were bleeding. "I just need to get out of here," I resolved, as I pushed toward the door. Some of the others were fighting for the door, trying to shove through and pull their desks along. I knew there'd be no way we could escape as long as we were shackled down. Then I looked up at the burning acid and had a horrible realization. "We need to let the chemicals burn through these cuffs," I told the girl. I held my arm at a specific angle and then scooted my desk toward the proper position. I bit my tongue and held in a scream as the tortuous radioactive material hit my skin and the metal at the same time. It only took 10 seconds for me to be free. And at the same time, I ran through the door, urging the others to do the same. The girl managed to pull through with only minor burns, and three others did the same. Then we heard a strange clang and realized that the class door was sealed shut. The ones that didn't make it out were now slamming their hands against the door, trying to wriggle the knob, but it was pointless. Next, we watched as the vents reversed flow and sucked the other people in the class toward the ceiling. It was like watching a real twister take up houses. All of them slammed against the roof of the classroom as we watched from the safety of the hallway. And just like that, the nightmarish event seemed over, and I was standing in the hallway looking down at my burnt, shaking hands. The other survivors were turning their attention to our new location, a long tile hallway that seemed to connect to at least a dozen other classrooms just like ours. And much like us, others had escaped hellish classrooms at the last minute and were trying their best to cope and recover in the hall. We all shared the same beaten and confused expression. None of us sure where we were or how we got here. "Attention, class. Please make your way to the main auditorium for a word from our savior," a voice said over the intercom. Then the lights in the hallway came on fully to illuminate the path toward the right. I looked to the others for ideas, uncertain of what we should do. There was an emergency exit nearby, but it didn't take one guess to assume it was sealed shut. So instead, all of us shuffled our feet down the hallway, following the guiding light to our next torture chamber. We soon arrived at what looked like a cafeteria, with long tables all arranged with simple school breakfasts, packaged donuts, boxed milk, fruit bowls. At least 30 meals were all lined up and ready for us as we entered the room. Each of them was sealed in what looked like protective plastic, the kind you might use in a chemical explosion. A couple of survivors went to check the exits, none of which had any windows toward the outside, while the rest of us settled and I decided to eat. Surprisingly, the food was delicious and fresh. "Our captors must want us somewhat healthy," I said, as I carefully opened the milk. My hands were still shaking. Then I saw a shadow cross the black curtain of the stage that overlooked the cafeteria. Immediately, I jumped up and pointed. A few others saw it, too. "Who goes there?" one man shouted aloud. The shadow paused. It looked unusually tall. Then we heard this strange, obnoxious laugh. A second later, the curtain pushed back and revealed a costume mascot. A large stuffed insect costume that resembled a roach with a goofy cartoon smile and five enormous floppy arms. From the center of the stage came a microphone that rose up to the roach's misshapen antenna. "Well, what a squeaky clean group you are. Welcome, class," it announced happily. I couldn't tell for sure if the thing was a robot or a person in a suit. "Today's been fun, but don't forget, the fun can only last until the bell rings, and then it's time to learn, learn, learn." "Are you for real? What is this?" one man asked. He abruptly jumped toward the stage, ready to attack the mascot. A moment later, two children wearing gas masks pushed their way out from the curtain and stood in the way of his attack. It made the man pause in confusion, and that's all it took. One kid whipped out what looked like a cattle prod and stuck the man straight in the chest with it. He flew back hard to the tile floor, coughing and wheezing. Then a few other children appeared alongside the mascot. All of them wore generic uniforms and gas masks. "Remember to play nice," the roach chuckled. Just as he finished talking, we heard a buzz, and the doors to the cafeteria unsealed themselves. "Recess!" the kids all squealed as they ran back behind the curtains and out of sight. All of us who'd survived the initial insanity gave each other a long stare, and then we bolted for the doors. I could see sunlight. I was ready to taste fresh air. But it was a mirage. The moment we stepped out to the playground, I suddenly realized I wasn't looking at the sky at all. It was some strange reflective surface that covered the entire surrounding area. "It's like we're trapped in a giant fishbowl," one man realized. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Folks, prices are going up everywhere. So I'm guessing if you heard that Mint Mobile is offering an unlimited wireless plan for $15 a month for 3 months, surely there must be something hiding there. Hidden fees, secret overages, have to trade up to a phone with all the latest bells and whistles, switch to a new number that means your family and friends all have to update their addresses. But no, no catch here. You just sign up today with Mint Mobile and enjoy $15 a month for your first 3 months when you sign up today. What are you paying for with your current provider? Do they ever tell you? What services go into all those fees and bills you pay every month? Well, I say there's no better time to make the switch to Mint and start saving. You get unlimited talk, unlimited text, and data on the nation's largest 5G network service, all for the cost of your average fast food value meal. And that's just one meal. Best of all, keep your phone, your contacts, your number. Everything travels with you to your new low-priced service. I say, jump onto Mint Mobile today, and you'll start noticing that Mint isn't the only thing that's the color green. It's also the money you're saving. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/dark. That's mintmobile.com/dark. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/dark. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
I got a good look at the playground. There was plenty of equipment, all of which seemed to be in good working order, and a long, tall fence with barbed wire that surrounded us on all sides. Again, we were reminded that the entire area was being used as some kind of radioactive testing site with warnings on every fence. Just as the last survivor came out, the cafeteria doors slammed shut. "No entry until the bell rings," a sign said on the doors, as we looked around and tried to get our bearings. "This has got to be some kind of crazy dream. What is this? Lord of the Flies?" a woman asked as she approached a tall juniper tree that was growing near the center of the playground. There were names carved on it, hundreds of them, and tally marks, counting the days and stuck here. I realized as I saw that they covered the entire base of the tree. Then we heard a strange whirring noise, and we watched as some of the equipment seemed to move on its own as if someone was using it. All of us took cover under the tree, too frightened to move. The children, who wore the gas masks, came out and started to play on the equipment. They seemed to have no concern for us at all. I took a step toward the swings. One girl was pushing her friend, and I started to have a conversation. "Can you tell me what this place is? Why are you wearing that mask?" I asked. "Keeps us safe from the bad air," she said in a sing-song voice. "Then why don't we have one?" A man behind me grabbed the little girl, forcing her mask off. I held by a cry of shock as I saw her disfigured face. How long had she been here that the radiation had distorted her so badly? "What's wrong with you? She's just a child," the woman shouted. "You saw what they did earlier." Another air raid siren signaled the children to run inside. The little girl picked up her mask and put it back on. "You are not the saviors, so you don't deserve protection," she said innocently. The playground soon became empty except for the few of us who were prisoners. "We need to get inside and figure out what's going on. If we stick together, maybe we can get out of here," I told him, and the woman agreed with me. A few stayed in the playground, arguing they could climb the fence. As the sirens got louder, I noticed the sky was growing darker. I shouted for the others to follow as projectiles of fire rained from somewhere above, debris from another explosion. The woman pulled me into the school as we watched the few survivors who stayed behind her burnt alive by the falling debris. "We don't have time to hesitate. Survive or die," I shorted. I was too frightened to disagree, following her into a rusty old gymnasium. We were lined up on a brick wall with bleachers facing opposite us. There were still plenty of us alive, but from the moment we stepped into the gym, I realized that probably wouldn't last long. The children, who seemingly were in charge of this place, lined up on either side of the squeaky, clean tile floor. All of them were holding a bright and shiny red leather ball. I know immediately what we were going to play, even as one boy stepped up into the middle and held the ball up. "PE will include dodgeball, jump rope, and then a physical fitness test. Remember to do your best." I was so sore from the other incidents that I wondered if I'd even have the ability to make it through these unscathed, but I knew I didn't have a choice. "We work together, we can make it out of here," the petite girl next to me said as the whistle blew. A second later, the spheres the children were holding changed from harmless, ordinary dodgeballs to spiky, dangerous, urchin-type objects. I knew one hit from those sharp protrusions would likely kill us if it struck a vital organ. Immediately, the children began to hurl the dense weapons toward us, the heavy balls surprisingly bouncing and moving across the gym floor with ease. We had little chance to do much else besides run. "Toward the bleachers!" one man shouted excitedly. A woman beside him was struck in the head with the spiky object, the full force of the needles piercing her face and knocking her down. As soon as it did, I also noticed that the needles seemed to latch onto her cheek, preventing her from being able to remove it. A moment later, as I ran, I realized why that was. We heard this soft, rhythmic beeping noise coming from the dodgeball. It got faster and faster as I noticed it was counting down. Then the latch opened, exploded directly onto the woman's face, killing her instantly. A man to the right of us, he was a little luckier, if you consider the loss of a limb better than dying, and his right leg was blown up from the force of another object. As he hobbled and crawled toward the bleachers, he begged the children to stop their onslaught. They all looked at him, their gas masks hiding whatever emotion they may have shown, and then raised their weapons, smashing them down on his pleading body. We turned away before the explosion caused his innards to scatter across the gym. "This is madness," a woman snarled as she rushed toward one of the children. I watched as the dodgeball struck her straight in the chest, but she kept running, tackling one of the children. To my horror, the bomb went off, killing them both. Then a sharp alarm noise came overhead, and all of the children stopped what they were doing. A moment later, the roach mascot entered, the ridiculous, costumed creature waddling over to where the kid had died and examining the scene. It occurred to me that the children seemed to be in awe of the mascot, as though awaiting its orders. Was it the one that was really in control here? Was it the savior that was mentioned earlier? "Looks like all of you will be getting detention," it said in the same null voice. Was it even human? "Enough of this! Who's in charge here?" one man snapped. He stepped toward the roach boldly, and I fully expected to see that the children might attack again. Instead, the stuffed insect held up an arm and kept them at bay, remarking, "All shelter survivors who make it to the end of the day will be hearing an important message from the Savior at our awards ceremony." "I think this thing's just a robot," the petite girl commented. I realized that I felt silly for not even thinking of that a moment ago, and watched as the roach left with the remains of the child, perhaps to be cremated somewhere. Whoever was running the show clearly cared a little about the kids that were here, but why none of them seemed to be remotely acting like regular children was beyond me. Had they been down here since they were born? And before I even had a chance to ponder it, the main kid in charge announced we were beginning the next activity. "Please choose a partner for jump rope," the children ordered. I looked toward the girl, figuring that with her slim figure, it was a safe bet she could make it through to the next game. "I'm John, by the way." I offered my hand out to her. "What does it matter? We're probably going to die here anyway," she said, as she refused my friendship, but added, "I'm only going to partner with you to make sure I make it to the next activity alive." The others that were still alive did the same thing, and then we were placed in the center of the floor, and the children brought out normal-looking rope that they extended between our feet. As an added challenge, they next bound our feet with chains. The one older girl in the group commented, We want you to act as a team. As they came up to me, I got a good look at the boy who was chaining me down and saw that he had a tattoo on his ankle. What's your name? I whispered to him. Oh, those sorts of things don't matter here, he answered back. I tried to look for some spark of humanity left in him and wondered briefly if any of these kids were even real either. Was the entire facility run by lifelike drones? The whistle pierced the air a second later and the rope began to move. Quickly, my partner and I jumped and I matched her rhythm, worried about what would happen if we missed. A moment later, the rope caught on fire, the burning heat making me begin to sweat as the kids strategically made their rope move faster at a steady pace. The girl and I did well for a short minute, but then, as they began to speed up, the flames would hit our ankles almost every jump. It made me want to cripple over in pain. The two women behind us both tripped from the rope and were burnt badly and fell down on the floor, begging the children to stop. Where are your parents? Why are you doing this? Thankfully, it seemed as though death was not their immediate fate, as the children moved on to other participants and started to perform double dutch with other members, making it twice as hard to avoid the Fleming rope as they sped up. I could hardly keep going, even after 2 minutes, and the heat seemed to get even more intense. Finally, after about half of our group was hit by the blazing weapon, they moved on to the next activity. All of the remaining adults who hadn't been burnt were told to wait in the locker room for further instructions. As we were huddled inside the tight space and the doors were locked, I realized that this was, for the first time, since the playground, that we were all alone. If anyone has any ideas on how to get out of here, it's appreciated, the girl commented as she rubbed her sore ankles. I was in so much pain, my entire body felt numb. I had no idea if that was a blessing or a curse, to be honest. That weird mascot mentioned an award ceremony later, probably back at the cafeteria. But I think I saw a main office near the front of the building. I bet you anything there's a control room up there. Someone must be in charge of telling these children what to do, a man said. And how do you suggest we get there? Seems every move we make is monitored, I asked. We'll work together, just like I said. These are just kids. They can't stop us if we use force, the girl offered. A woman next to her shuffled her feet uncomfortably. I don't know if I can justify harming children. It's likely they've been brainwashed to obey. We shouldn't be hurting them, even if they are doing this to us, she admitted. I felt the same, but didn't say a word. It was clear the majority was ready for this nightmare to end. If we can get the people in charge to end this idiocy, maybe it'll save the kids too. The needs of the many will be accomplished by just a few, the man argued. Oh, you're just speculating. We don't even know if any of this will work, another said. Soon, the locker room burst into an argument. The door slammed open a second later, and one of the older children opened it wide for us. The physical fitness test will now begin, she announced, leading us back to the gym. All of the adults that had suffered from burn injuries were gone, and now, in the middle of the floor, I saw that the actual tile floor was missing. I even rubbed my eyes to be sure I wasn't imagining things. It was, in fact, cut off by what looked like a bottomless hole, a chasm that cut through the whole area. I tried to look down and see if there was anything below, but it seemed to stretch for miles. Perhaps into some furnace below, or perhaps it was a nuclear waste dump. That would make sense, given this entire facility. Looks like it was meant to be a fallout shelter. Dangling over the pit was a rope, which seemed to be covered with oil to make the climb even more difficult. Did the children even understand they were literally making us risk our lives? I was placed in the front of the line and waited as the bell rang. The rope was only a few feet in front of me, but I still had to make a running start for it. Leaping out above the pit, I grabbed onto the slippery rope and quickly started to climb. Even with the oily surface, it was still possible for me to ascend, but not easily. I could hear the others actually cheering me on as I tried not to look down. But just when I thought that I might make it, the game changed, and something above me fell through the roof vents. Radioactive ash. Burning particles struck my head and against my hands as I clung to the rope and shivered in pain. It wouldn't be long before I lost my grip entirely. My only chance was to try and swing back toward the edge. I started to shift my body weight as I slid down a rope, my hands sweaty and the onslaught of falling needles making my nerves begin to stress and ache. Just as I made the third swing, I let go, barely grabbing the edge. The others rushed to help, but the children blocked them. If I was going to survive, I would have to be on my own. Desperately, I clawed my way up the side, gasping for breath, as I collapsed to the ground and looked down at the pit. This is insane. I can barely even stand up from this torture. I moaned as I looked at my shaking palms. The chemicals had hurt more than I'd realized. The children looked at me, then the oldest one, in charge, ordered, "Take him to the Savior." Before I knew what was happening, I was escorted out of the gym by several larger kids toward the office that the one man had speculated we might be able to use as an escape. A bag was placed over my head before they marched me down the hall, shoving me rudely as they moved forward. Eventually, I was placed in a chair, and my hands were bound with a zip tie. Then the bag was removed, and I found myself staring at another adult in a nurse outfit. Someone who was running this hellish drama. She gave me a fiendish smirk and said, "Looks like you thought you were going home early." The nurse administered some kind of shot directly into my bloodstream without even bothering to tell me what it was for. As I watched the needle press into my body, I was sure that I was about to die. Instead of a quick death like the other adults here, it would be slow and torturous, and this strange woman would revel in my suffering. Immediately, I started to sweat and feel faint, my lips clammy as I begged her to stop. The entire room felt dizzy, and then, at last, she tossed the needle aside into a biocontamination container and commented, "My, you certainly are a squealer, aren't you?" I was panting, hardly able to see or speak coherently, but it didn't matter. She was going to make me listen to her strange ramblings. "You've been brought here for a reason, Survivor 6091, and that is to prove yourself worthy of readmission to society. Given your skills so far in our shelter activities, you stand a high probability of being able to graduate from our program," she commented as she pulled a file from a nearby metallic cabinet and read off my file as though I had died long ago. "John Redders, age 32, single father living in the suburbs of Chicago. You have two children, David and Susanna, aged 8 and 4, respectively. You work as an auto mechanic and enjoy chess and hiking in your spare time," she commented as she slid the profile across to me. "Does all of this sound accurate?" Despite how parched I was, I managed to give her a whispered reply. "I have no idea what you want, but once I get out of these handcuffs, I swear I will kill you." She leaned toward me, smiling coyly before smacking me across the face with a gloved hand. "You will learn that we do not tolerate insubordination of any kind in this facility. Do I need to remind you why you're here?" she snapped. She turned the folder over to the next page, which showed photographs of me having drinks with friends, spending time at work, long hours, and not coming home to be with my family. Things I had felt guilty for over the past 6 months, bad habits I was struggling to cope with. And here they were on display as crimes, my sins that had landed me in this hell. "You're fortunate that the charges aren't more severe, or we wouldn't even be having this conversation." You've forsaken your family, Mr. Ritters. You've fallen into a lifestyle of pleasure rather than responsibility. As a result, you squander what money you earn and your children starve. You are a poor excuse for a father, and therefore unfit to return to being a parent until you're taught a proper education. This place was built to show what happens to the world when children have no authority. When the bombs fall, and only children can create a new society, it will not be one of order, but chaos. That's what we've created. I didn't fully comprehend what you were saying, but I gathered that this prison was a place for people like me to be rehabilitated under whatever strict guidelines they enforced. A second chance, according to their standards, to be a better person and prevent some Armageddon. And if we failed to be strong enough, then a deadly fate awaited us. I knew her logic about health and recovery and being a good parent didn't line up with the atrocities that I'd seen here so far, but I was too frightened to correct her. "When is this graduation ceremony?" I asked. "Tonight, after the final period. We'll gather our students together in the band hall for a celebration and announce the graduates. But to make it there, I needed to make sure you were on equal footing with the others. Hence the need for your vaccination," she commented.
"What was it for?"
"As I'm sure you've learned, the contamination here is quite real. Reading your file, I realized that you might actually be more susceptible to the effects than the others." I looked toward the needle, wondering what exactly she'd dosed me with as a bell rang, and the nurse stood up, pleasantly smiling. "Enjoy the rest of your day, Mr. Ritters. Hope to see you again tonight. I think if you apply yourself to your skills, you'll go far," she said. I was marched by masked children back down the hall, confused and disoriented, even without a bag over my head, as we passed by what looked like class photographs of previous grads. As I paused to look at the numerous alumni, it occurred to me this secretive program had been running for quite some time undetected. Who could be handling all of the finances, and how did they even find people to be candidates for their experimental doomsday prison? Another sobering fact was evident about the photographs. Less than half a dozen persons were in each picture. The rest of the seats were empty, meaning the chance of survival here was slim, perhaps nigh impossible. Still, I had to think about my own two children and fight to survive as long as I could, even if it did mean against the others, I thought as I was escorted into an art studio. There were perhaps only 9 of us left, and as soon as I entered the classroom, each of them viewed me with new suspicion. It was easy to guess why. I had been given special privileges to not go through with the remainder of the fitness test, and that must mean they think I'm involved in whatever's going on, I thought as the children ordered me to take a seat near one of the easels. Our teacher, the strange, motionless, costumed roach, immediately gave us instructions on the assignment. "Each of you is filled with inspiration, aspiring dreams that are waiting to burst forth. Here we get the chance to express ourselves and show our achievements on the canvas," he explained as the children locked the doors. Whatever was about to happen, I knew good and well it was not going to be as pleasant as he claimed. "Under your desks, you'll find the tools you need to create a masterpiece. Something that truly speaks to us and helps us to see what type of artist and person you really are," the mascot said. All of us reached down to take a small black bag from the underside of the desk, unzipping it to reveal razor blades and other sharp objects that typically people would use for self-harm, and the costume mascot explained. "You have 30 minutes to put your sweat, tears, and especially your blood into your work. Those that put in the most effort will get to move forward to the next event, so try your hardest and work for a better grade than your classmates." Immediately a timer was started above his head, and we looked at the objects in horror, realizing that he expected us to actually cut into our flesh and let our own blood act as paint for the project. Was this some twisted way of saying how people would survive a nuclear apocalypse? It was a morbid reality we were facing, and none of us wanted to admit to what lengths we'd go to in such a situation. But I didn't have a choice. I cut at my burnt flesh. The others hesitated and started to use the razors on their skin, wincing and shrieking in pain as their blood dribbled onto the paper. One woman had a different type of masterpiece in mind, though, and immediately lashed out toward one of the other adults with a sharp weapon, stabbing them to the ground. Surprisingly, the costume mascot did nothing to stop it, and after she killed her art partner, the woman announced, "I found out she'd been sleeping with my husband, so this is my artist's depiction of what I want to do to him." She spit on the bleeding corpse even as the mascot nodded and announced, "You get a 90. Head for the music room and enjoy your extra recess." She dropped the weapon and stepped over the body, leaving the rest of us confused and befuddled, but also no less suspicious of each other. "What about you, John? What did you do?" The petite woman I'd talked to earlier asked as she held the safety blade in between her knuckles. I couldn't tell if she intended to harm me or the others as well. None of us could be certain what the others were capable of. As I looked down at the bloody mess, though, I began to dizzy and stumbled across the room to vomit. It must be the side effects of whatever the nurse gave me, designed to make me incapable of completing this task. I realized as I vomited in the trash can several times and felt the room begin to spin. One man tried to approach to help, but I pushed him away, uncertain if those in charge would view it as cheating. I needed to act fast, and the only thing I could think of was to use the blade against myself and threaten to hurt myself. If this is really supposed to be about retaliation, then let the rest live. Let us get out of here. Let's make the world better, I demanded. The children actually seemed to show emotion for a split second as I held the knife against my wrist where I knew the most blood would be spilled. It was a bluff, but I needed to see if my guess about this demented facility was correct. Would they allow me to survive simply because of their twisted moral code? "That'll be enough," the mascot bellowed, motioning for everyone in the class to stop. He went from desk to desk to look at the artwork, supposedly grading each and every one of us as though it really mattered. It felt like our survival was going to be the toss of the dice. Myself, the petite woman, and two others were told we could head to the music hall. I knew that meant the others would be executed, and as the knife was wrestled from my hand, I considered trying to stand up for them. I'd been able to make it back to my own family, I kept reminding myself, as I felt the strange vaccine the nurse had given me start to take effect. If I don't push forward, it'll all be for nothing. I knew she wanted me to feel the full effects of the radiation in the air, and whatever she'd given me was already taking effect, but I had to ignore it and keep going. Somehow, I got the impression the others, who were told to leave, had the same guilty conscience, and we all reluctantly were led away even as the art studio doors closed, and we heard the ones left behind beg for their lives. A roar of gunfire and paintballs filled the air, and we heard their screams grow higher, almost to a crescendo, until at last everything became silent. Then paint and blood mixed together drained from under the door, a sickening feeling in the bottom of my stomach as I realized that the four of us were the only ones still standing for this final round. We were taken to a music hall where the children told us to pick out an instrument, and I found myself hardly able to stand up from another bout of nausea. Then, as I finally reached the flute stand near the middle of the class, I saw the playbook was open to a song that told me my suspicion was right. We were nearly at the end of this mad game. They were going to force us to play the ceremonial orchestra, followed by a funeral procession theme. Slow, soothing music began to play as all of us took our seats and watched the children line up against the wall. Despite the pretense that everything was fine, I knew good and well that only a few of us would survive this final test. I didn't know the people alongside me in this class, but I still couldn't believe that all of them might be dead in a few minutes. As the music got a little faster, the children ordered us to start playing, and we did our best to keep up. I've never even had talent for music, but I tried my hardest to appease them, even as I felt the room beginning to move. Everything was suddenly shifting around as we kept playing, the room rotating as we saw behind the walls a row of strange small holes that had sharp spikes poking straight out. I knew that if we stayed where we were sitting, we'd be impaled in only a matter of seconds, so I tried to stand. Only for something to shock me and cause me to collapse back in my seat. "The performance mustn't stop," a child said as the room kept rotating. We all reluctantly played, and as we did, I noticed that the room began to move the other way. Someone was actually getting the music right. "Keep playing correctly," I shouted to the woman. She had a trombone. I could tell that she was exhausted, but we couldn't afford any mistakes. One man was about to be hit by the deadly acidic darts and tried to flee, only for the agonizing shock to cripple him and cause him to flail backward toward the weapon. He screamed in pain as the spikes pierced him, but didn't kill him. We kept playing to the end of the song to keep the rest of us alive. As the chorus came to an end, the room stopped moving and the children cheered. Some even suggested an encore. I could tell that the woman, who had kept us alive those few moments, wouldn't have the strength to play again, and thankfully the encore was not required. To my surprise, as we were moved from the band hall toward the mess hall, I saw the nurse who'd tried to kill me was waiting for us with what looked like awards. Since there were only three of us left, I was hoping this meant all of us would get the chance to make it out of here. But I noticed that she was only carrying two awards. One of us would be put to a final test, I realized, as we were told to stand at the center of the stage. "All of you have managed to come so far in this program, and we can't thank you enough for all your hard work to reach the top of your class," the nurse announced. As she was talking, I saw that the auditorium was filling up with children. I was surprised to see that there were so many of them. At first, it was just a dozen, but then I realized there were hundreds of them. Did they all live here in this underground hell? How did they survive? "Before we pass out the awards, I think it's time for a quick snack for all of you," the nurse said as the doors at the back of the cafeteria opened, and I saw more adults rolling in carts. I held my nose as the stench of rotting meat overpowered me, and I saw that they were actually being fed the corpses of all the other adults that hadn't made it this far. The children didn't even wait for a serving bell. All of them took their masks off, and we saw how the radiation down here had transformed them into beasts. They growled and snapped at one another to grab a piece of the chopped-up bodies and chewed it as fast as they could. I felt like I was about to throw up again by watching the cannibalistic display. This was not a future I ever wanted to see play out. Now I knew what these children were being turned into. Monsters. I didn't care to have any other questions answered, too sickened by the realization that if we had lost, we'd be in that meal as well. To my surprise, the petite woman that had been here since the beginning reached for my hand, her eyes filled with tears, as we listened to the children eat the flesh of our competition. "My name's Samantha, by the way.
she whispered as her lips trembled and the children finished the last bits of meat. But for a moment, there was a connection between us, a mutual understanding that we didn't deserve this treatment, despite whatever issues we had in our real life. Nothing could even come close to this level of hell. Then the nurse got out a raffle ball and started to spin it, the numbers clattering around as the hungry killer children waited to hear who would be crowned the champion. I didn't have to guess that what would happen to the loser. "Our graduate in this class is none other than John Ritters. Step up here, John," she announced. Immediately, the children moved toward Sam and to the others, ready to pull down and eat them alive. I tried my best to hold on to her for as long as I could, her screaming and kicking the entire time. "You'll forget about this place soon enough, John. I knew you would make it. Your sins in the world above kept you healthier than the rest. Come, as we get ready to leave, there's one final thing I need to show you," the nurse ordered. I tried to keep from looking as the children trampled and attacked my new allies. I was so traumatized by the event, I found myself shaking as I moved toward the back hallway. "I'm sure by now you recognize that this entire process was orchestrated to make you a better person and consider a better world for our children. But we couldn't have done this without people who were in predicaments just like yours. Down on their luck, angry with loved ones, scorned. We want to offer you the chance to be able to recommend a future survivor to us to share this vision," she said, passing me a small pamphlet. "You mean someone to send here to die?" I realized. "If they can survive our tests, they'll be fine," she commented softly. She soon led me to what looked like an old elevator that had a key code to prevent anyone from entering. And as she got me ready to leave, she added, "Just think over all that you've learned here. I'm sure you'll see the benefits to our program." Then she injected me with another dosage, a strong sedative this time, and pushed me into the elevator. I couldn't even open my mouth to scream as the door slammed shut, and I found myself getting dizzy. The last thing I remember was the elevator rising toward the surface. When I did wake up, I was in the middle of a heavily wooded area. It felt surreal to imagine that everything I experienced was real. The pamphlet the nurse had given me was more than enough proof. In addition, the wound on my wrist was all stitched up. I walked for about a mile to the road, and from there I hitchhiked. "Where to?" a passing motorist asked. They actually looked a bit nervous to help me, and it was then I realized I still had the clothes from the prison underground. I probably looked like an escaped convict. I told them to take me to the nearest police station. I told them my story from start to finish. I showed them the wound on my wrist. I also insisted that they could check my clothes for fingerprints and gave them my pamphlet. There was nothing in their database that matched any known criminals. It suddenly occurred to me this was likely why they'd trained the children to be their foot soldiers. None of them could be traced, and likely all of them had been kidnapped in infancy. I thanked the officers for their time and managed to get a ride home from one of them. I was desperate to see my children again. Once I got home, I made a promise to them that I'd be a better father. I could only hope that time will erase some of my awful memories of that hell. The radiation that afflicted me still ravages my body, making it difficult to breathe, and my hair falls out daily. I don't know how much more time I have left. This is why I must tell others of the pain they're afflicting. If even one person believes me to stop that apocalyptic school, it will be enough.
I hope you enjoyed Armageddon Drill by Kyle Harrison as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed that tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Kyle-Harrison. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/KYLE-HARRISON. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I would like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. And before we go, I'd also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs, or become a patron for as little as $5 a month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyre channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, too. Just search for Otis Gyre. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyre. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyre channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.